On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions, it all adds up to the new equation.
A couple of dominant themes on the front pages of the Sunday papers. The Irish Mail on Sunday is the first one in front of me. Defiant Dáil Golf Society plots its return. This is by John Lee, who was with us to go through this morning's papers. We'll discuss this in a few minutes' time. He tells us that the controversial Oireachtas Golf Society is preparing to tee off again, despite the Count Corla having publicly called on it to disband. Count Corla, Sean O'Farrell, called for the group to be wound up shortly after news of the Golfgate scandal broke. However, members of the society confirmed this weekend that they will be returning to the fairways this year, and we can also reveal that the RTE broadcaster Sean O'Rourke will be returning to RTE following the dismissal of all of the charges at the Golfgate trial in Galway District Court this week. A member of the Golf Society told the Mail on Sunday this weekend, "Reports of our demise have been greatly exaggerated. We are looking forward to returning to the links in 2022. We also look forward to welcoming all of our colleagues, including those who have gone through such a hard time." I suspect we might have some differing opinions in the studio this morning about whether all of that media response at the time was appropriate. We'll get to that, as I said, in a few minutes' time. The Sunday Independent has an opinion poll which tells us that the Golfgate decision was wrong, according to the Court of Public Opinion at least. But the main story on the front page of the Sindo is the cost of living crisis. It has overtaken the housing crisis as the country's main worry. That is according to the same poll carried out by Ireland Thinks for the Sunday Independent. A fortnight after most COVID-19 restrictions were lifted, a clear majority say the cost of living, 56%, up 28 points in a month, and housing, 55%, are now the two most dominant issues facing the government. COVID has now tumbled 18 points on the list of concerns, down to 9%, even though a majority of people don't believe the pandemic is over. More people also want the government to postpone the stated carbon tax increases than any other single measure to help curb inflation. Carbon tax is due to increase on fuels for home heating oil and the likes this coming May. Sinn Féin has proposed delaying the tax because the price increases are going to hit households. There's also a party support opinion poll, which we'll get to as well a little bit later this hour. The front page of the Sunday Times also leads on the cost of living crisis. We're told that the government is to consider making a one-off bonus payment of between 65 and 100 euro to low-income families and older people in order to help reduce the cost of living for vulnerable households as inflation takes its toll. At a cabinet subcommittee meeting this coming Thursday, ministers will discuss either doubling the planned energy credit from 100 to 200 euro per household, or increasing it to 150 euro, but also giving then a more targeted payment through the fuel allowance scheme to those who are in greatest need. The government is also planning to cut a range of state costs, such as parking fees at hospitals, renewal fees for a passport or driving licence, as it prepares to respond to the 20-year high in inflation, which has been driven by huge increases of energy prices and rents. Also, on the front page of the Sunday Times, new estimates that at least officially 620,000 people contracted COVID in the 6 weeks of the Omicron wave, but the true figure may be closer to 1 million when you include antigen tests and also those who didn't actually log their results with the HSE. And also from across the water, Boris Johnson has told allies that he is determined to cling on to power as he prepares to face a conference vote, possibly as soon as this week. He is making it very clear that they'll have to send a panzer division to get him out of there, says some British wag, of course, using their famed penchant for military analogies, which is in no way unusual or a sign of a country with a deep trauma. Finally, for now, the front page of the Business Post. New bill may push more legal costs onto those who take insurers to court. This is from the junior minister responsible for company regulation, Robert Troy. He is proposing to change the rules for people who bring insurers to court so that if the ultimate ruling is the equivalent of what they would have got from the Personal Injury Assessment Board anyway, then they will have to pay higher legal costs. As it currently stands, claimants very rarely have to pay any legal costs if they fail to get higher compensation in the courts or in out-of-court settlement. Under this new legislation, they will have to pay their own legal costs and the legal costs of their insurer if the subsequent court award doesn't exceed what they would have been given by PIAB anyway. The idea is to try and get more people to take settlements out of court rather than going the full steps to the courts to try and get some sort of response. That is your view of what's in the front page of this morning's newspapers. As I said, John Lee, Group Executive Editor of DMG Ireland, which is the publisher of the Irish Daily Mail and the Mail on Sundays, with us in studio, as well as Gabby Gedevitskita, who's a political correspondent with the Irish and Sunday Independents. Good morning to you both. John, I'll start with yourself just on the, because we probably will have a row about Golfgate, so let's just put that off for a few minutes and let's talk about the other major issue, which has been illustrated by the Sindo poll today, which is the cost of living and what the government is going to do about that, because it seems that they are not really still ruling a lot of things off the table just yet.
Gabby was telling me beforehand, she's far more diligent than I. She was speaking to a lot of politicians during the week, and I think there wasn't a suggestion that wasn't made during the week.
Yeah.
Bar,
there's a lot of kites been flown, wasn't there?
Yes. Bar the actions that should be taken rather than giving 100 quid there and 100 quid there. What the government are revealing here about these kites that are being flown is they can't actually do anything about the cost of living. We are a country in a monetary union. We can't take the economic steps that are required of a sovereign nation often. They are to move around your currency in whatever fashion you can, deal with interest rates. Otherwise, the only way to deal with rising cost of living is increased wages. Mm-hmm. And that then leads to something called tit-for-tat inflation. And it goes on and on. I don't really think they can do much about cost of living. They can improve, in some areas, supply to deal with demand. Mm. You know, spiralling rents are a huge part of our inflationary problem. Spiralling house prices are a part of that as well. And there are supply issues which I think are also beyond their ken. But ultimately the problem is when you are, and we saw this during the crash, we don't have the power to devalue our currency. We're in the euro and the ECB rules that. We don't have the power to deal with our interest rates on a global level. We can, banks themselves can deal with domestic rates.
Yeah, so then if you can't do those things, you can either put more money into people's pockets or you can try to make stuff cheaper. But putting more money into people's pockets, which is the obvious thing that everyone wants. We saw the controversy this week when the Bank of England said, don't go looking for higher wages. But if you don't want to put more money in people's pockets, you have to make life cheaper. And then that's when you see then the government going, well, how do we do that? Other than trying to slash all of their charges and taxes all over the place.
Yes, and then you have inflation where people are more but money in their pockets. Mm. And as you
after
point
a pandemic
out there,
where people have loads of savings.
Some people. I don't know about you, but we certainly found ways to spend it. My kids did too. But the problem when you don't have those broad, blunt tools is you have tax cuts. Mm. Pascal Donoghue has made it clear recently that doesn't seem to be an option, but it probably will need to be. Mm. And certainly in Britain, which is a huge influence in our economy, Boris Johnson is holding out the potential for tax cuts down the line as his big rescue facility. Mm. Whether we can do that here or not, I don't know. But I don't believe, and I know it's of great help to struggling households, and I wouldn't be dismissive of anything like, and I don't think they should be called handouts either, how they could assist struggling families. And many families are struggling, but I don't think it's going to have a huge effect on livelihoods in the way that tax cuts do, or increased social welfare payments.
And Gabby, I think the challenge for the government is that if they're ruling out any kind of a budget style thing where they start addressing tax cuts, and if Michael McGrath is on the front page of the Business Post telling us that these measures have to be a once off, if they're only going to have one chance to try and get this right, then they're going to have to do something which is significant and targeted and correct and effective. And that's a big challenge.
Yeah, it's a big headache for the government. And I kind of think it's one that nobody really saw coming. I mean, if you look at the Ireland Thinks Fund independent poll. So, you know, one of the biggest worries, biggest concerns now for people are, I suppose, the cost of living 56%, housing 55%. And I think the expectation would have been that housing after the pandemic is apparently over would have been the biggest issue. But I do think that the government, in fairness, you know, this coalition, three-legged stool of a coalition, took power during the pandemic. And it was sort of this, you know, I suppose what was established was essentially, if we have a problem, for example, we have a lockdown, we're going to put in place financial supports. We're going to put in place the pandemic unemployment payment. EU is, you know, if there's an issue, we're going to throw money at it.
Yeah.
And for a number of weeks or months, you know, that's going to tide us over. And then the problem is solved. And now we're coming out of the pandemic and the government is seeing, OK, here's a problem. The cost of living is rising. Mm. We're going to do exactly what we did during the pandemic, which is throw money at it again. And like I said, you know, I mean, the kites, the sky was full of kites this week. I mean, we had everything from, you know, passport and driver's license renewal fees maybe potentially being halted for a couple of months, to emergency department charges being waived. I mean, everything you could possibly want was thrown out for government sources this week.
Fuel vouchers, food vouchers, tax rates, tax bans, tax cuts, social welfare rates, tax cut-off points.
Motor tax, I think, was another one. Like, everything was on the table, and I think the government kind of needs to realise that this is a, it is a huge issue. I don't know how much they can actually do to help with the cost of living, but the reality is that we have to come out of this thinking of we have an issue, we're going to throw money at it. Mm. And that's why you have Michael McGrath coming out and saying, look, it has to be a one-off. Because we don't have an infinite pot of money. If you talk to anybody within government, they'll tell you, well, the tax returns for January were great. Look at us, we've loads of money. But like, there's an argument there to be made for, look at all the problems that, you know, still exist within society. If you put money into long-term investments, for example, public transport, in the long term, people will say, okay, do you know what? The bus service now next door, so, you know, just outside my door is so great. I'm going to get rid of the car.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is an argument there to be made for actual long term investment as opposed to short, quick fixes.
John, when the government is ruling out the idea of having a mini budget, like, I understand the rationale for that because it's so early in the year that if you go back to the drawing board, then suddenly everyone comes in with their claims for everything and then suddenly a small package becomes a really big package because you've just drawn everything back up again. But when things are at the scale that they are and people are feeling the pinch in ways that the government itself even admits that it didn't foresee when it drew up last year's budget, is there not maybe a little bit more of a compelling argument for the government to actually say, no, you're going to have to go back to the drawing board here because things are difficult. And if this keeps going the way it is, most households are going to really struggle here.
Then we go back to the validity or the of budgets at all, and it's probably something I got in a bit of trouble for earlier this year. My boss got on to me and said I wasn't taking the budget probably as seriously as I should.
Mm.
Again,
was that because all of the contents of the budget had already been splashed in every paper for three weeks previous?
Again, more diligent journalists like the two people here in the room were miles ahead of me, so I was sitting there. What else? But again, I think you go back, and this is my opinion, you go back to the lack of power our government sometimes has in monetary affairs. Another issue that was something everyone needed and was a great move in many ways. At the beginning of the pandemic, let's not forget, and we probably discussed this when we discussed Golfgate, where we all were mentally. There was a great fear thrown on us all by every economist on the planet that we were going to go into a nuclear winter. The ECB then crucially printed money, which it hadn't done during the crash, mm-hmm. and left us in a situation where we had to bail out our banks and everything else. But as they found in the United States with Joe Biden's trillion dollar bailout, that has an inflationary effect as well.
Yeah.
So it's arguable that the bailout, helicopter money as you call it, has happened nearly 2 years ago. And now we're coming back around to deal with the inflationary cost that has caused. So yeah, if a mini budget could achieve something, great.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, as Gabby just pointed out, the Minister for Public Expenditure, who controls an awful lot of this, says these payments are one-off.
But you could do a mini budget and that would be a one-off thing, wouldn't it?
It would be, but I suppose...
The government made, you mentioned the tax returns. Didn't the country take in like about $1 billion or maybe over $1 billion more in VAT alone last year than it fully expected to, which is something of a windfall, which is the government expected to be able to get by with less. So if they had the scope to charge us less VAT and make the everyday cost of doing a bit lower, could they not just do it?
Yeah, Taoiseach Micheál Martin came out and said very clearly, financially, you know, we're doing great and geez, there's loads of money around. And I suppose the argument there is to be made for, look, you know, we're all, you know, tax-paying citizens, and if the government is in a position to help out its citizens, then surely it should move to do so.
So why not then do the mini-budget?
But then does that mean we're going to have a mini-budget every 6 months when the going gets tough? You know,
we did the last time the code went off. We had three budgets in 14 months. It certainly felt like things were piling up that way. I just don't know whether people, if the real measures that would help people really feel like they were going to get through all of this would mean some cut off in tax bans or maybe some tweaking of VAT rates or something, the sort of stuff that you'd usually only do as part of a budget. If the scale of this is so significant that it needs really urgent stuff, then it seems like, yes, welcoming, you know, the idea of scrapping a driving license or a passport renewal fee or A&E charges or hospital parking, getting rid of all of those is well and good. But for a lot of people, that doesn't help anything. I'm not going to need a driving license renewed this year. I'm not going to need a passport renewed this year. I hope not to have to go to A&E. I hope not to have to park at a hospital all going well. None of those things will address my life in any way.
Yeah, so the argument for that is that, you know, these one-off costs, for example, like the passport renewal, which can cost, I think it's about 78 euro, that, you know, if it is the case that you do have to get your passport renewed, if you already are, you know, in a household where, you know, money is quite tight, that's a big hit. That's the idea behind, you know, measures like that. Or if you have to, for example, God forbid you broke your leg and you have to go to A&E and you have to pay that charge of 100 euro, that's a big hit for money that you you might not necessarily have. So that's the kind of thinking that's coming there. Look, I think it's difficult for the government because they're kind of looking at it and they're saying, what is it that we can do? You know, they're looking to even double the energy credit of 100 euro to maybe, you know, 200 or maybe 150. You know, they do have options, but I suppose the thing is they have to really think about targeting things properly. There's no point giving everybody in the country 100 euro off the electricity bill unless they actually do need it. I know in the Sunday Times they're reporting that there might be sort of, you know, 65 to 100 euro for poorer families.
Yeah.
But like, how
makes much. Makes some sense, I think. Yeah.
Which is some sense, but then again, how far is that actually going to go to help them, you know?
Yeah. One person has used the hashtag on the record NT to say the government is probably only ruling out a mini budget because they're going to give themselves another pay rise this month, which is. It's a slightly cynical take, but I suppose I could probably understand what motivates them to think that way. This same opinion poll, which has found that the cost of living is the biggest concern facing the country at the moment, has also, John, done its usual round above the parties and where they are. Everything is broadly where you'd expect it to be. Sinn Féin out in front, Fine Gael commanding a position in second, Fianna Fáil in third. Down 2 points since the last poll, down to 17%. Jodie Corcoran has written an analysis piece under the headline, Fianna Fáil decline looks terminal. Would you agree?
Well, maybe the terminal decline set in 10 years ago. They Fianna Fáil took a seismic shift in where it stood in Irish politics and Irish life 10 years ago, which I don't think it'll ever recover.
I remember the front page of your newspaper around the time of the 2011, your newspaper in the Mail on Sunday, at the time of the 2011 election being called, Bat O'Keefe being called up by one of your colleagues looking for an on-the-spot reaction to Fianna Fáil's report, and he hadn't seen what the poll said, and it was put to him that Fianna Fáil were at 12%, and the headline then wrote itself the following morning, Sunday morning, it's splashed in the Mail on Sunday, 12%, Jesus. That was the headline. But that was, you know, back when 12% was worthy of a splash, to where someone just goes, Jesus. Fianna Fáil 12% now, you'd sort of go, yeah.
I think I'm trying to think of where that was. I don't think it was even done on the phone. I won't say where I think that quote came from, because it was okay. Might have been done a little more face to face. I can't remember. But there you go. Micheál Martin will tell you that, and it's a year ago, I think, since I interviewed him properly, that Fianna Fáil are at a certain point in their political cycle that all parties in Europe find themselves at. The day of in a system such as ours, of a party having 42-43% is gone. Sinn Féin may disprove that, but their polling doesn't show them anywhere near that either. I think Fianna Fáil have, and we've discussed it on this programme before, have some pretty fundamental changes to make, and pretty simple changes to make that they haven't done.
What's the silver bullet?
There's, you know, an election happened only 2 years ago. I saw some of the things that they were very, very strong on that they weren't strong on that time out, which was a huge surprise. Little things like postering weren't great. You know, they had no manifesto. And to say now that you fought the Battle of the Somme 2 years ago and you're going out to fight it again in another couple of years, what's your battle plan? Well, it's pretty much the same as it was last time. That's not going to work. That's where the leader's position comes into focus. He has to illustrate to his party that there is an electoral plan, because elections are all that matters. Mm. Their social media has been criticised by themselves in a report in the investigation by Sean Fleming into the general election. I haven't seen anywhere near a reformation in that area, and it is so important in politics. And they can do very much what Frank Flannery did for Fine Gael in 2002 when he reformed their party and their electoral strategy. What he did was just copy Fianna Fáil. It was simple as that. They can look
which Fine Gael, I guess, will not be doing now then, if that's
no,
your prescription.
Probably not. Yeah. Probably copy Sinn Féin, but that's what you do. And they look, if you look at Sinn Féin, and an awful lot of what they do is so effective. There's a constant mantra from them. It's so ineffective is the mantra for me that I can't remember exactly what it is. But they frequently say, out of time, out of touch, soon to be out of government, about the government. Mm. That's repeated over and over again on social media outlets and the media, in the Dáil, and it's hammered home to the public and it's having an effect. Now, if you're Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, you take that template, it looks a bit too simplistic, but I don't see it being done. Now, there are very, very boring, really boring issues there with Sinn Féin's economic policy. You know, you can bang away all you like. Sorry, and I don't mean to use that term. You can talk all you like about their history and their connection to the IRA in Northern Ireland. That is clearly not having an effect on the public, on the electorate. Mm. It's the economy that people vote on. We'll see in the next election, according to polling, it'll be on standard on cost of living and on housing. Sinn Féin have made proposals prior to the last budget a few months ago that will affect and deeply influence how people vote in the next election. Pensions. Pensions are a huge issue. All polling shows it's not actually a grey issue. It affects people of our age, your age even. I'm a bit older.
Thanks.
But people in their 20s and 30s consider their pensions. Sinn Féin has proposed that anyone earning over 60,000 euros a year, which won't be that much when we see wage inflation by the next election, will lose the tax credits on their pension payments. On second homes, which an awful lot of people in the country have, they have proposals that are going to make it very difficult for a person to own an investment property. Maybe a good thing, but those issues are not being hammered home by the government. It's almost they think they're in government and we don't need to criticise them. We'll show them how we do things. And I'm sorry, for all the spin, for all the debates, for everything else, housing is a huge, huge problem. And can they deal with that before the election? The innovative measures aren't there.
You'll need to see some major movement in that, I think, in the next 3 years before the country goes to the polls again. Gabby, I do need to get to a break, but I just wanted to pick your brain briefly on page 5 of the Business Post, a long read by Daniel Cal, the political correspondent there, about how Fine Gael members are worried about the ongoing criminal inquiry into Leo Varadkar's leaking and the shadow that it threatens to cast over all of their 2022s.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is dragging on and on and on, and there seems to be no end to it. I believe the Sunday Independent reported recently as well that, you know, that Taoiseach Ardtánaisí, Leo Varadkar's legal team have gotten on and said, look, where is this case at the moment? And I think this story actually is a good illustration of the problem that really every party leader in government has. They all have some sort of an issue and none of them are really safe. I mean, you're looking at Eamon Ryan. He's kind of being hammered by former ministers within Fine Gael. You look at, you know, Taoiseach Micheál Martin. There's some rumblings of a heave. The heave seems to have now been gone. I will just say on John's point, I don't think the changing leader in Fianna Fáil is going to solve all their problems. I think they have deeper identity crisis issues, and that the party doesn't know what it's fundamentally about anymore.
A radically different plan, then fine. But I don't see that plan.
And if you look at it, and just on the story in the Business Post, this criminal investigation is hanging over the Taoiseach.
Mm. 15 months now.
Yeah, and it's rumbling on. And I suppose it's not just Fine Gael are kind of looking at it, going, you know, where is this going to go? Because if he is going to be, if there are any sort of charges forthcoming, there's no way he can take over as Taoiseach.
No, well, he certainly probably couldn't even stay as Fine Gael leader if that's the case. My producer Mick has very helpfully pointed out that such was the response to the Pat O'Keefe poll. It was in October 2010 in the Mail on Sunday, obviously with an election coming up. It wasn't even 12 or 14%. It was 18%.
Oh,
the headline was 18%, oh Jesus. Cowan's closest cabinet ally sums up Fianna Fáil horror at latest poll slump. 18%, which is now par for the course.
What would they do for that now?
A lot of text coming in. Maybe something the government could drop the so-called emergency USC that we'd all been paying for 11 years. Amazing how little hassle the government gets about making that a forever tax. Mm. Someone else, Peter in Wicklow, says, simple, just cut VAT to 20%. Here we go, says someone else, tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. How about, instead of cutting tax, we fund proper public options for our population so that there's an affordable option for people to counter inflation. Give us back our USC, you robbing so-and-sos, is the conclusion from one person who has been tweeting News Talk this morning, saying that as a squeezed middle taxpayer, am I supposed to presume that inflation doesn't affect me? I've already started cutting back on food and clothes because some prices have gone up 15%. So just give us back the universal social charge, they say. Joe wonders, why is the US of A allowed to rack up trillions in debt, but then we sweat about a few billion? Can someone explain that to me? Because the United States will never repay that debt. That's a long question on monetary policy, Joe. We might get back to that someday. They did propose to get rid of all their national debt once, and then they ended up saying no because actually it was more sensible to keep some debts, if that makes sense. Aidan Regan from UCD, a regular contributor to the show, points out that there's an important difference between consumer price inflation, which isn't necessarily a cost of living index. Governments may not be able to do much about general inflation when it kicks in, but they can use their fiscal powers to address the cost of living issues. And Colm has texted in, final text on this for now, the government is making massive extra tax out of higher energy prices. Surely they could just give us some relief by dropping at least one of the taxes that they charge. In case you're wondering, by the way, he says, those various taxes are VAT, excise duty, VAT on the excise duty, carbon tax, VAT on the carbon tax, the National Oil Reserve tax, And then the VAT that they charge on the National Oil Reserve Tax as well. That is from Colin. In fairness, Colin, the amount of tax that they charge on taxes, it's very useful if you want to pay for stuff, but I absolutely take the point. John Lee of the Irish Daily Mail Group and Gabby Gadowitz-Keeter from the Irish Independent are with us in studio. There is a lot of reporting today about Gulfgate, some interviews with some of the protagonists, and a lot of them basically saying that they're glad all of this is over and they want to come back. As I mentioned earlier on, John Lee, you're reporting today that the Oireachtas Golf Society is now planning to return. That it, there was some talk that it was going to be disbanded, but that they're going to have an AGM again later this year. You've also got a column further inside the paper basically questioning whether all of the reporting at the time and all of the public outcry was actually justified in the heat of the reel.
I would always say this, that I would like to think I'm far more nuanced than that. It is one of the great, the finest and greatest news stories that I've ever seen, and that's proven by the fact we're discussing it again today. Mm. So, what has struck me throughout the pandemic is the unevenness of it, and I know it all hit us very quickly, and laws were introduced overnight, but there was an incident in the Department of Foreign Affairs 8 weeks before Gulfgate. Mm. And Simon Coveney has told us that he was informed that night that people had broken social distancing regulations. A report 18 months later said there was a serious breach of social distancing guidance. The people involved produced photographic evidence, which they then kindly put on Twitter. Mm. Simon Coveney was informed of it that night, and he did nothing. He didn't inform the Gardaí. He didn't initiate an investigation. This is his account, because he trusted his Secretary General, who took the photograph. Mm. And on we go. 8 weeks later, because of... And I just think there's a very interesting intellectual inquiry to be had into what happened 8 weeks later. Then the authorities decide to move against a bunch of middle-aged and sometimes elderly men who had done something extremely unwise, that deserved punishment in some fashion, because the media decided to go ballistic on it correctly. Mm.
So is the balance then that the media should have gone, there should have been more media and public outcry about Niall Burgess tweeting the champagne picture, or did the media go over the top in Gulfgate, or is it both?
I have no criticism of the media that I'm part of. It's a vast homogenous group. And it's not for me to defend us all, because we're all rivals in many ways. What makes a news story? That's a day for another intellectual discussion. But I'm not saying I'm providing the answers here, but I am asking the question. Mm. Why did the ton of bricks come down on this event? Mm. Because it's extreme, really annoyed people. Flippant fashion, but not wholly, because I approach it as a journalist. I point out that when I've written stories down the years about politicians, put it nicely, dossing, and they're walking on the street, walking on the beach with their kids, no one cares, throwing golf, and for whatever reason, people completely lose their minds on it. Now, a judge decided last...
Do you think if they were at some other social affair that wasn't linked to a golf thing, it'd be perceived differently?
Again, Gavin, I ask that question.
Yeah. As a golfer, you ask that question.
At the end of the pandemic, what we don't know is why some people were prosecuted. I went and asked the court service for statistics on the number of similar court cases that went to court. Mm. I have that in my piece today.
Yes.
On this issue.
And they don't have the statistics.
And they don't have the stats because they don't reach the bar for collecting those stats.
Which means not very many.
No. Yeah. We had, even more bizarrely, and I actually think, and you guys reported on this as well, that inquiry into the DFA incident was just bizarre. So a year and a half down the line, you decide, once again, because of media attention, so you're running government based upon Twitter and newspapers, to have an inquiry. And that inquiry excludes all the run-up to it, which, to me, you organise a thing before it happens. Mm. On one day...
I didn't fully overlook it. I mean, if you read the full report, it does go into the origins of how they were all there and the circumstances under which they all gathered.
Absolutely. But they didn't... They confined the events, the inquiry, into one day, which was the 17th of June 2020. Right. There was a story beforehand that there was an email sent on the 16th of June about this event. And then, without precedent... in the civil service or politics, and I've been covering it a long time, they decide that the way to solve this was ask a person on €200,000 a year, the former Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, to donate €2,000 to charity.
Yeah, so the long and short of it then, I'm going to pick Gabby's brain about her thoughts on this in a moment. So the long and the short of it is that you don't quite understand why this became such a big deal when other perceived infractions of the COVID guidelines were just kind of overlooked or didn't attract nearly the same opprobrium.
And I'm making clear I don't understand it. Maybe someone has an answer for it. And I think that's the point of what the media do, is that we highlight the facts and let people make those decisions themselves. There was another incident in the Healy Ray bar down in Killorglin, which the Gardaí decided not to investigate. Yeah. There was an event which Leo Varadkar attended at the Merion Hotel, where he said he probably didn't break restrictions.
Yeah.
But the Gardaí didn't investigate that. So who decided during all of this that the Gardaí should investigate particular events? Though I saw evidence of raids being conducted in parts of Dublin during the pandemic. Video evidence of it. They weren't investigated.
A couple of texts before I get Gabby's brain on this. The media outrage over Golfgate and the Department of Foreign Affairs episode is a joke, frankly. The whole witch hunt was a total waste of time. Journalists need to cop on with their gotcha nonsense over irrelevancies, Ronan. Ronan, I will offer my retort to that after I allow Gabby to have her thoughts on all of this.
No, I absolutely. I think there was a point made during the week that Golfgate, because everybody was cleared, there was no charges were all dropped, that it was a non-story. I think that couldn't be further from the truth. I think I would say to John that, you know, because I think the one thing that the Department of Foreign Affairs in a weird way benefited from was because details of Champagne Gate, as it is now known, emerged a long time after it actually took place. And that was something that Merion Gate and Golfgate did not enjoy. And that's why they were probed as heavily as they rightly were.
Because they don't emerge in the same cauldron of anger.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it is significant that Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, knew about the event within his own department the day that it happened and then chose to do very little about it. I will say, though, however, you know, what makes all of this a story is that during the pandemic, we've seen countless examples of this us and them mentality. And I wrote about this at Christmas time when we saw the details of the chief executive of the HSE, Paul Reid, you know, the fact that he had he was kind of being driven around in a very nice car by a member of the, I think it was a soldier driving around, the member of the Defence Forces. You know, we've seen obviously revelations of Champagne Gate, and, you know, Simon Coveney came out and said all of the officials in his department were mortified after details of Champagne Gate came out. You know, but that's great. You know, if I went off and I broke restrictions and I was mortified, well, the fact that I was in Ivy House obviously seemed to have changed it. I mean, people who did break restrictions all over the country, they paid fines, you know, they were prosecuted and held to account for it. And I think what makes all of this so relevant is that it is this us and them mentality of there's one rule for the so-called elite and there's another rule for people who are not civil servants or not secretary generals or not politicians or, you know, are not members of elite golfing societies. You know, once they make a mistake and once they, you know, they have to face the full onslaught of the law.
Someone else has texted in, by the way, to opine that maybe if all the people in Clifton were at a James Joyce day out, there'd have been nothing said. Plenty of James Joyce days out in the last couple of weeks, I'll tell you, with all the centenary stuff about Ulysses. Someone else says, adding Gate to every single news story is now a pandemic in itself. We're now entering a week of, was Golfgate a witch hunt gate? So to those who, again, Ronan and plenty of others listening today, who think the journalists need to cop on with their gotcha nonsense. And I'm very aware that the offer, the view that I'm about to outline will be seen by a lot of people as the media trying to defend the opprobrium that they did whip up 18 months ago when the Oireachtas Golf Dinner first emerged into the public eye. Gabby, you made an interesting point a second ago about all the people who had to pay fines and the likes. And people who had to pay fines or people who were prosecuted because they were breaking the law. There were laws that were introduced. All of these things were translated into the law. Not all of these things were translated into the law. But oftentimes, the regulations, the public health advice were translated into law. And if you broke them, that was a crime and you had to pay a fine for it, or in some cases, maybe even a jail. what happened in this instance was that the we have now allowed all of the handling of Golfgate to be narrowed down into the lens of, was it a crime? And the question before the courts in Galway were was basically, could you throw up a partition in a crowd of 80 into two groups which were less than 50? And was that enough then for it to be considered two gatherings of less than 50? And was it therefore in keeping with the law? And Judge Mary Fahey this week in Galway decided, yes, that means that it's in keeping with the law. What people have forgotten, and I understand why they've forgotten it because it's been 18 months since, is that the day before the dinner took place, Dara Cleary was a member of the cabinet that sat at the table that signed off on newer COVID public health restrictions. Now, they weren't yet law. There was a while before they would become law. So they didn't have the binding force of the guards being able to go in and enforce them. But politically, the government had asked everyone in the country to clamp down on their social lives. In fact, actually, we have a little bit of the speech that Micheál Martin gave in a televised press conference, which was shown live on RTE and on Virgin that day, where he outlined some of what the country was expected to live by.
We are significantly tightening key restrictions for the next 3.5 weeks to September the 13th. Because the spread of the virus is increasing across a wide range of settings, these restrictions will impact on most of us. It is advised that all businesses should continue to facilitate remote working where possible. All visits to homes will be limited to 6 people from outside the home and from no more than 3 households, both indoors and outdoors. Outdoor gatherings will be limited to 15 people. Restaurants and cafes, including pubs operating as restaurants, can remain open, but with mandatory restrictions on closing times of 11:30 p.m.
So the guidance there, as Micheál Martin outlined it at that press conference, were that restaurants and pubs, including hotel restaurants and the likes, were all supposed to close by 11:30 p.m. As it happens, that night after the dinner, there were some people in the residence bar until the early hours. The Taoiseach didn't put in a very fine point in that clip, but it was in the government's press release issued on the same day that in restaurants, including hotel restaurants now for functions, with the exception of weddings, which were still allowed to have the indoor gatherings of 50, there should be a maximum of 6 people from no more than 3 households allowed at a table. There were 10 tables across the 2 rooms in Clifton. Only one of them had as little as 6 people there. All the others had more than 6 people, which was beyond the public health guidelines at the time. The table that did have 6 people at it was the table at which Dara Cleary and his wife and Donie Cassidy sat at. And there were, Noel Grealish as the society captain. And there were people from 4 households at that table. So the public health advice that had been issued the previous day was simply not followed. Now, the contention was always that, well, the Hotels Federation has to figure out ways to translate the government's advice now into some sort of operational guidelines. I don't think the rest of us had much patience for that at the time. We were told on a Tuesday by Micheál Martin standing up in government buildings that these were the rules we all now had to follow. By the way, Dara Cleary then went on the 6-1 News that evening and was the government talking head to explain why all these things were necessary. So Dara Cleary goes on the 6-1 News on a Tuesday and says, we all have to follow these rules now. And Dara Cleary then goes to a dinner on the Wednesday night where none of those rules are followed. And just because 4 people were not prosecuted successfully for organising this whole affair in the first place, it doesn't mean that everything was suddenly then tickety-boo and that journalists managed to whip up a frenzy out of nothing. We had a cabinet minister who sat in an event which was plainly in breach of what his government had signed off on the previous day and sat there and maybe felt a bit of discomfort but did nothing about it. That's why a minister resigned the following morning without having to be the subject of much media opprobrium. That's why the Lasca Hearluck of the Shannon resigned. That's why 6 members of Shannon Éireann lost the whip. That's why a Supreme Court judge was almost pushed to the point of resigning because of his judgment about going into that room on the day. It's not why a European Commissioner resigned. That was because he couldn't get his story straight about where he'd been for the 2 weeks previous, whether he'd broken Kildare's local lockdown at the time or not. Just because a criminal prosecution was not successful, it doesn't mean that everything was fine and that journalists completely overreacted. And I defy anyone to text into 53106 and tell me otherwise.
I don't know who's disagreeing with you.
Mm.
There's a lot of people disagreeing with me.
And
including some of the texters like Ronan and everyone else. Gavin, it's about government politicians, a former AG, a sitting judge, media personnel. It's given the most transparent view of Ireland work. Someone else then saying, you know, I'll never forget Liveline the day after Golfgate broke, the hurt and anger of people's voices. And then you have Ronan saying the media outrage is a joke, frankly. The whole witch hunt was a waste of time. journalists need to cop on with their gotcha nonsense.
But do you remember the time when the Golfgate broke? I mean, there was outrage. Like, there was, you know, and that still remains the case. It still happened. Everything that, you know, was reported at the time is still correct.
So why then do we have the papers full of speculation that Jerry Butterman will be able to become the Cathaoirleach of the Shannon this year because apparently he's now vindicated? Why do we have Micheál Martin opening the door to Dara Cleary rejoining the cabinet maybe when there's a reshuffle this year because apparently he's been vindicated? Why do we have Donny Cassidy talking to Liam Collins today in the Sun Independent talking about how it's great and all the messages from well-wishers came in and he's glad that it's all over? How come he's not as mortified as the people in Ivy House over organising something which may have been in keeping with the Hotel Federation guidelines, which may or not have been criminal, but which was so profoundly and demonstrably against the spirit of the sacrifices that the rest of us had been asked to do, including by one of the attendees at his own dinner? I just cannot fathom the sense of forgiveness and why suddenly it's the media that were the big bad guy who were taking down innocent people here.
The politics of this are interesting because the politicians don't... And we interact with them every day. I interact with them every day. They have a skewed view of life. They think that Phil Hogan, by losing his job in Europe, was somehow treated badly or some injustice was done to him.
A point made by a texter right this minute again. I've just returned to Ireland for many years abroad. I'm disappointed about the lack of wider respect and that Ireland lost its commissioner with a trade portfolio at a time it really needs it.
Phil Hogan dodged quite a few controversies in domestic politics. He went off to an extraordinarily well-paid job. And we can't even get all the details of how much an EU commissioner is paid, but it is just mind-boggling what goes on there. Mm. Dara Cleary is one of the more decent people you meet in Leinster House. A lovely man. I think a lot of people would say he got on with him. But frankly, there's a view would say he got what he deserved. So did the rest of them. You know, you can't behave the way they behaved and think that you don't face ramifications. But in politics, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar are now perceived as having panicked. And there is...
You're making the argument that they panicked, are you not, in today's column on Sunday?
Most of what I write is based upon conversations with politicians.
Okay. So it's not necessarily your view.
There is a... My perception of what they did... is based upon also somebody initiated a Garda investigation. We don't know who. Yeah. The DPP decided to send it to the court. That is the system behaving the way it did. There is an alternative view that would say perhaps if a Garda investigation was initiated in 2 days' time, were you then influencing the Garda investigation by sacking a minister? And don't give me this, the minister resigned because he felt it was the right thing to do. He would have only felt that he'd lost the confidence of his leader.
Well, the news broke on a Thursday afternoon. He resigned on the Friday morning when he was due to be doing the morning radio rounds, including on this station. It wasn't because there was a suspicion of Garda investigation.
No,
it was because he knew he did the wrong thing.
But a Garda investigation initiated afterwards.
This event should not have gone ahead in the manner it did, given the government decision of last Tuesday, was the statement put out by Micheál Martin that morning.
So then politically, the perception is they panicked. Because these guys have been exonerated or, as said outside the court at some point, vindicated. And now they're trying to calm down the parliamentary parties for a few weeks. This line that I was given yesterday, that Jerry Butterman could well come back into the Shannon, into a very, very plum role, which he well deserves within party, is coming from politicians. This line that Micheál Martin has said publicly, that which I frankly find laughable, that there's a spot now for Dara Cleary to come back. How's that going to happen? Like, ultimately, you're going to have to find wrongdoing in another agriculture minister and get our third and sack them. Dara Cleary's route back into politics is not there, and that's a fiction. There is no vacancy there for him, nor will there be. In the interim, 1.5 years, there have been other junior ministers who have performed very well, and they will consider themselves having that job. This is a secondary round of leaderships of parties panicking, because now they're being told by their party faithful that they panicked then. Mm. Micheál Martin has a reputation for sacking people. He sacked Niall Collins and Timmy Dooley back in 2019. He then went on to sack Barry Cowan, Dara Cleary, Leo Varadkar, jettisons people when they become a problem very, very quickly. Francis Fitzgerald, he overlooked his three Praetorian Guard after the last election, and then Phil Hogan went, and you know, you pay the price politically when that's the tactic you use.
Can I just make the point that I think in the media and in politics, we do become trapped in a little bit of an echo chamber. And I think that just because some political commentators are making the point that, well, now Golfgate is a non-story and that, well, the four lads have been vindicated, they're in the clear, they can come back. I don't think that's a reflection of what the general public actually thinks of Golfgate. And I think, Gavin, in fairness, in your contribution there, there's a lot of, you know, all the points that you were making, I think the public still believe all of those things. I don't think anybody in the general public, if you were to stop them on the street and ask them, do you think the Golfgate was now right because all the lads were cleared down in Galway? I don't think they'd say it was right. Mm. I think they still, you know, the public would tell you, well, I missed a funeral. I didn't celebrate. I had to postpone my wedding. I didn't get to see the birth of my grandchild. You know, all of these things that ordinary people went through because they stuck to these strict restrictions. And just because a few people have been vindicated, I think that anger is still very much
there. And alternatively, we have to look at how we can punish civil servants, senior civil servants, for what they do. And we don't seem to have a facility for that.
And two holes in the account.
There are two people who were in that photograph in the DFA who were promoted to ambassadorial positions. There's an old diplomatic tool called recalling your ambassador. Very easy way to deal with it.
Final text on this before I go to a break because I'm long overdue one. Someone says, can there please just be an expiration date for people being punished for a stupid decision while also not pretending that they've somehow been vindicated when a criminal case was never the issue in the first place? A bit of nuance would be handy, not in this conversation, but in the headlines this week. We do have a couple of minutes to talk about some of the other things in the papers. We'll get to them after this. Gavin Riley with you till 1 o'clock. Gabby Gedevitz-Keita and John Lee still with me in studio with a few more minutes to go through some of today's papers. I mentioned the piece on the front page of the Sunday Times about how Boris Johnson is going to need to have a panzer brought in to get him out of number 10, which is, again, an entirely normal and rational and in no way slightly weird analogy to continually draw about people who are under pressure. There is, in fairness, a lot of written today, which we shouldn't allow go unremarked, about what's going on north of the border and how the DUP are really not likely to be part of a Northern Ireland executive for quite a while. Quite a few bits written across the papers. Gabby, anything that jumped out for you?
Yeah, Rodney Edwards is writing in the Sunday Independent how the Democratic Unionist Party leader Geoffrey Donaldson has claimed that Minister for Foreign Affairs Simon Coveney hasn't contacted him in months, which doesn't exactly, you know, inspire confidence for
not even a Christmas card.
You never write.
North-South relations. I thought that was quite interesting. In terms of Boris Johnson, I mean, it is incredible when you see the story rumbling on and on and on and on, and it really is beggar's belief that he still is the Prime Minister. There's also, I believe, reports in the Mail on Sunday across the pond, and I know both in the Irish Mail on Sunday also, about, you know, Carey's role in the Prime Minister and some of his key decision making.
And there's now a deliberate attempt to get rid of what they're calling Carey's cabinet.
I wondered how long it would take to get round to blaming the woman.
This is a world where
Yoko Ono was blamed for breaking up the Beatles, even though she wasn't in the Beatles and they maybe have fallen out with each other. So, I mean, that's just a complete diversion. Mm. Boris Johnson's responsible for his own decisions and politics comes into it. I heard elsewhere that he is a big majority. He's got a lot of goodies to dish out in the next couple of years. I think maybe predictions of his demise might be slightly exaggerated.
I did see, in fairness, before we go talk a little bit more about the North again for a second, there's one ingenious tactic which saw being ascribed to number 10 this week. They're obviously waiting for the critical mass of letters to go in for the motion of no confidence. Apparently they've got some of his own loyalists to put in the letters so that then they'll know when they reach the threshold. Graham Brady, the chair of that committee, will call them around and just go, do you still stand by that? And that's the so they'll know before it happens what sort of numbers that they're at, to make some transparency out of a very opaque thing. On Northern Ireland, and I don't say this because this is how I feel, but John, can you explain for just a few seconds why anyone in the Republic really ought to care too much about an ongoing row between Sinn Féin and the DUP up north?
I suppose, I mean, that's a historical question. Why should we should care about our people in the north? But of course, on a daily basis, it will affect our economy, the ability for them to do business, and ultimately there could be a situation in 5-10 years time where Sinn Féin are in government on both sides of the border and events in Northern Ireland would affect us far more than they should. But this is the ongoing Brexit thing. It affects us more than anyone else in Europe, because we have a land border with Britain, whether we like it or not, and it affects our economy. So Boris Johnson, along with Simon Coveney, is criticised today for not paying enough attention to Northern Ireland. And Geoffrey Donaldson has asked him, maybe along with Simon at the same time, to visit Northern Ireland and get this thing sorted.
What do you think are the chances of that, Gabby? The argument is being put forward that Boris Johnson appointed himself as Minister for the Union. So if he really wants to try and keep things on the road, he ought to go there and chair the talks himself. Do you think that's likely?
Is it actually going to happen? Probably not. Should it happen? I think so. You know, I think that we've seen in recent weeks and months, you know, there's a lot of, I suppose, still a lot of anger in the North. And you can see that from the moves this week of Paul Given resigning. And I don't know what the solution to it is. I think that certainly, and I do think that, in fairness, I do think that the government in Dublin does have a role to play in, you know, stepping in a little bit. And if it is the case that Minister Coveney hasn't contacted Geoffrey Donaldson in months, like, he should pick up the phone and do that. I know he's had, you know, headaches here, and that's fine. But in fairness, like, I don't think we should forget about our counterparts in the North.
If you want something done, ask a busy man. And Simon Coveney certainly has a lot on his plate at the moment. We are completely out of time, John Lee of the DMG Group, Executive Group Editor. Thank you very much. Gabby Gadabskita, political correspondent with the Irish Independent. Thank you very much.
On the Record on News Talk.
Brought to you by PwC. Great minds think unalike. Different skill sets, diverse opinions. It all adds up to the new equation.